Ah, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Right Time Book Club. This summer, the book that we are using is Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. We're going to have Lonnae O'Neill of The Undefeated to talk about the book at the end of the month. We'll have Mike Freeman himself to talk about the book in August. But first, we're going to talk about the first 100 pages or so of the book with ESPN's Howard Bryan. I almost said ESPN the magazine, but I guess that is not what it is no more.
More months.
Okay, gotcha. I didn't say I didn't know the technicals on that. I didn't like fully read the memo in particular, but we talked on the phone the other day, and one thing you asked me was why I chose this book, and I told you like the reason that I did this was I think Jim Brown, I say when Jim Brown dies, we're going to have a hell of a time figuring out what exactly it is that we are going to say about him. And I thought that this book overall is a pretty level look at him that doesn't get too caught up in the mythology of Jim Brown at the expense of some of the things that aren't nearly as glamorous as what he was as a football player. But the first 100 pages or so, we're really going through the 1950s on this. And I wonder for you, like, how much did you know about his experience at Syracuse before this book?
A lot of it was new. I remember the HBO documentary, Jim Brown, All-American?
Yeah.
Remember that. Also talking to Jim on a couple of occasions. But most of this was new and it was placed in really good context. I thought that it was one of these, one of the values of doing this type of assignment is going back and realizing all that you don't know. And I obviously, you know, read Dave Zirin's Jim Brown book last year. But Jim Brown's a shadowy figure in a lot of ways. I don't think that there's ever been that one project, that one definitive project where you would go into this and just feel nailed down and feel like, okay, I got this, the way you would say like the David Marinus, Vince Lombardi book or even the Richard Ben Kramer DiMaggio book. Jim Brown is a You're right. When the time comes, whenever you want to do some sort of retrospective on Jim Brown, it's never going to be easy.
Well, I found it interesting in this book. You know, of course, he was born in Georgia and then moved to Long Island. I think he said when he was 8 years old, he made the move up there. But one thing I find very interesting about him, and I think really does inform a lot of things that happened later with Jim Brown, is that he seems to have had what is an American rarity, which is an integrated childhood and adolescence.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's, I guess the best way to put it in reading those early pages about how Mike sort of sets up his childhood, he talks about St. Simon, where he's from down in Georgia, and then making that transition up to New York. And one of the tough things in retrospect, I mean, when you're reading these types of books, and obviously when you write books now, is that you try to read them, you know, can you read them as a reader? Or are you reading them, well, here's how I would have done it. And so it makes it difficult to sort of get a feel for the different nuances of the storytelling. But I always found myself somewhat skeptical of the Manhasset sections where they're talking about that, you know, we didn't have any racism here. I don't know why this town was different. And as an East Coaster, you know, who grew up in these types of communities where every community thinks they're different, the embedded racism in there is fascinating. But it was interesting that his memories of being in the South were so sharp as an 8 year old, or when he was even, I think around, I think 6 or 7, he really spent most of the time there. And then by 8, he was gone. So he had both in a lot of ways. He had the childhood of the, you know, the East Coast sort of Long Island integrated dynamic, but also he still had memories of the South too. So he got a pretty, even, you know, by the time he was a teenager, he had a pretty good shape of what America was kind of all about.
Yeah, and Freeman uses an example, which seemed to be a very formative story for Jim about, you know, his mother working down south or his grandmother, I can't remember which, but he goes there because the man that she worked for wanted to meet him because of, you know, his act, you know, everything that he pulled off. He said he went down there and that man shook his hand at the door and never let him in the house. And he was like, got it.
When I was reading that anecdote, I was like, okay, is he going to make him come around back? He didn't let him stand there at the front door. And so these customs the customs are so ingrained and they're so powerful, even when you try to have these heroic figures, and I know you want to get into Paul Brown, I'm sure, a little bit later, but even when you're looking at the Paul Brown character and how Paul Brown didn't have a racist bone in his body, or Paul Brown was one of the rare white men who, you know, who was willing to challenge the, you know, the segregation of the of both football leagues in the late 40s. And but still, that those customs and those attitudes inform everything. You can feel it.
I thought, I don't know if you've read Unforgivable Blackness on Jack Johnson, but he, but there's a story he talked about where Booker T. Washington was invited to the White House by Teddy Roosevelt, and he said he didn't respect that man. He said if he respected that, respected him when he had him there, he would have sat and had dinner with him, but he didn't sit and have dinner with him. Like, that's how you know that this was just window dressing. And you're right, when you talk about those customs, it is those little things like that that you stop and look at and be like, oh, okay, this actually isn't how you treat people.
No, exactly right. And this is how I'm treating you. So that's the thing where you – it's always when I read, I always take a look at a couple of things. One thing I always read when I'm reading fiction is how does the author describe black characters? And when I'm reading nonfiction, especially when I'm reading a biography like this one, I always take a look and see how the white particulars, the principles in the story – how they are describing the very environment that our protagonist, Jim Brown, is living in. And the gap is amazing. The gap, it's always very, very wide. And it shows you exactly the space between the black experience and the white experience, where you have the white coaches and you have the white people who are interviewed in there. It's almost like it's like, what game are you watching? These two experiences are lived so differently. And it's funny because you, as a writer and as a reader, you're asking yourself the question, is it the writer's responsibility to bridge that gap, or is the gap so obvious that it need not be spoken because you're reading it and you can sense it for yourself?
Yeah, no, this is like, and I have the same way as you were about the stories about Manhasset, where there's always something underlying, right? Like, there's always like it's hard to believe. But the thing about Jim is Jim always says this, that the most important men in his life have always been white men. You know, like, he, even though he is not.
Makes sense, though.
Yeah, but even still, though, he's not a starry-eyed dude about these sorts of things, and at no point was he in a position where he rewound and looked back at some of these men and be like, nah, they was actually more messed up than I realized. No, he's riding with them to the end.
Yeah, he's riding with the individual.
Yes.
I'm talking about the individual's attitude about the region.
Got it.
And so, and absolutely, it makes perfect sense because these people are the ones who are in power. And it's not just the power dynamic, but anybody who's a kid, anybody who can remember with any sort of accuracy being a kid. We all know, especially boys, and especially boys playing sports, people who take an interest in your success, you remember them for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
People who take an interest in you actually becoming something, because we're so used to everybody telling you what you can't be, you remember those people who said, wait a minute, this one was actually encouraging to me. And I do believe in that regard that it's not hyperbolic, nor is it fiction, that these guys really did take an interest in them. But I think it's also multitasking. You take an interest in these individuals, but you're also not out there crusading, breaking down barriers and breaking down customs. You're living within the custom while taking an interest in this individual.
Right. And then after that, the Syracuse stuff is so fascinating to me, including the fact that Jim Brown got tricked into going to Syracuse.
Got tricked into even going there. Exactly. The Syracuse stuff to me was, so far, was really, really, really fascinating. It was the most dynamic stuff that I've gotten to so far. And part of the reason is because it goes back to this question that we're having about the writer responsibility. And I'm interested in hearing what Mike's got to say about this when you have him on. The writer responsibility of filling in the gap, or just letting it speak for itself and letting the reader understand what they're reading. And this, the Syracuse stuff speaks directly to this entire question of how we set up sports. We set up sports as the meritocracy. We set up sports as the place where if my score beats your score, then racism doesn't matter. I'm faster than you. I win. You lose. We're straight. And we do this not just, and we talked about this with the Heritage last year. We talk about this in language. We got to level the playing field. We talk about it's embedded in our language, and sports has so much power, supposedly because of that, right? And yet you read this book and you see that, one, the coaches didn't want him. The coaches were as racist as anybody. They weren't welcoming to him. You find out and you recognize, if you really start taking a step back, that for all the talk about the meritocracy in sports, you've got quota systems throughout every single sport, whether we're talking basketball, where you're not supposed to have five black players on the court at the same time, where you talk about football, where you're not supposed to have more than 10 black guys on the team. Baseball was supposed to, you're only supposed to have two blacks, and you weren't supposed to have any black pitchers or black catchers. So it really does throw into stark contrast sort of the hypocrisy of all of it. That sports is no different. Sports is actually worse, because sports is the one place where you can just get on the field and play. It's not going to be someplace different where you're in a boardroom and you've got to figure out all these different politics within a framework. Nah, it's me and you on the field, and they still have quotas in that.
Hold on, not just quotas, but you couldn't have an odd number of either race on the team, because then you'd have to have one, just one, mixed roommate pair on the road. Although I have to say this on that level, if I am running the team, man, I can't imagine what that drawing names out of hats is like to decide who's got to be the one to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I have to admit, I wouldn't want that problem either.
No. And now, or if you're the Brooklyn Dodgers with Jackie, you just call a writer, you get Wendell Smith and say, Wendell, we need you to room with Jackie.
Yes.
You know, or you find another one to go find somebody black to room with our black players.
No, they decided to keep it even. But yeah, so, mm-hmm. You know, Jim finds out that basically they took donations from the hometown to send him to Syracuse, because the guy was like, look, if I get him in, they'll wind up giving him a scholarship. And that kind of sort of happened. But it's wild to read that and think about the very idea that it took a while to make football coaches come around on the idea of putting Jim Brown on the field.
And once again, what's it tell you? It goes back and it just lays waste. I don't care about the color of a man's skin. I just care if he can perform at the high level. Give me a break. Stop. Just stop it and stop making it seem like the coaches are somehow different. The coaches are the ones who are the worst ones, because the coaches are the ones who weren't going to put you in position. They were going to be the ones who weren't going to let you play quarterback or center. And they were the ones who weren't going to let you play middle linebacker and all in safety and all the thinking positions. So it is informative reading this, especially where we're at right now, and it just shows you that so much of sports, that this whole idea of the meritorious sporting environment is complete.
Well, some of what's interesting about this, and I'm curious what you think about this, because I grew up around in a largely suburban area around a lot of white people. You grew up in an urban black environment, and part of what jumped out to me about the Syracuse years is there's something about when you go meet like new white people as a black person, right? Like when you start your childhood and you're dealing with people year after year after year that you know you're going to develop some familiar relationships with people. And it's not some like it transcends race sort of stuff, but you get people that actually know you. And then you get to this place out of nowhere where nobody knows you, and you're like, whoa, this feels a lot more like what I've been reading.
Exactly. It feels way different.
Right. And that's what that really jumped out to me about what's going on with Jim, is like, I can look back at me growing up, and look, I went to school growing up in Waller County, Texas, which has been in the news at various points. You may recognize the town name. I don't look back at that negatively at all. Like, I don't have those kinds of stories and memories about me growing up. I moved to California when I was like 21, Southern California. And I was like, yo, why are these people crossing the street when I come around? You know, it was like, it was one of the most jarring things that had ever happened to me, because my optimism was slowly dying, I guess is the way to put it. And it sounds like that's what happened to Jim.
Yeah, no doubt. And what ends up happening, you find people get tested. We all get tested. And for me growing up, you found that your white friends were the ones who got tested even more. Because, yeah, I always had my guard up when I was around white people, especially around new white people, because you never knew when they were going to change on you. You never knew when the shift was going to come. And as you got older, you could tell it was always when the alcohol started flowing, when the adults started drinking or whatever, here come the slurs, and you knew that things were starting to go a little dark, a little sideways. But it was, to me, it was always when we were in new environments around new white people where you saw your white friends. They were the ones who got all squirrely because they didn't want to be judged by being friends with you. They were the ones who were waiting to get you know, to get all the slurs and to get attacked for even defending you, and you knew they weren't going to have your back because they didn't want to deal with the weight of that. But it's true. I think that when you're, you know, when you're looking at the Syracuse years, the shock of the, I think the sentence that Mike had in there where he said something like that the racism was not the, you know, the, or the tolerance was not the same once you got beyond Manhasset town limits. It was sort of like, okay, on the one hand, you were like, well, that might be a little hyperbolic in the middle, thinking, okay, well, Manhasset wasn't all that what they thought it was. But it was also sort of that stark reminder that the minute you got within 10, 15, 20 feet of your personal surroundings, things were gonna get real, real hostile.
Yeah, no. I want to talk about...
It didn't take much, you know what I mean?
Right.
You just take... All you need to do is go a mile, going like in Boston. It's definitely like that with Boston. In Boston, you go in the wrong neighborhood, all of a sudden it's like being in a foreign country.
Well, you know, people talk about this with St. Louis. Was it Del Mar Street? All you got to do is cross it.
Just cross it. That's the same in Boston.
The other side of the street. That's all it takes. Like, there's only one place in New York that I really feel that. It is when you go on the east side, when you go above 96.
That's a magic line, absolutely.
Yeah, 96 is such a line. You're like, yo, how did that happen so fast?
How did that happen so fast? It's true. Well, that used to be the magic line across the west side, too, is that the minute you crossed that line, the taxis wouldn't go above there.
Yes.
You know, that's why they had all the car services up in Harlem and everything else, because that was the magic number, you know. You know, you stay below it, you were in Manhattan, you stay above it, and you were in, you know, you were in Darktown.
Yeah, I got to say this, though. If there is a bright side to all the white folks moving into Harlem, it is a lot easier to get a cab. I remember 2007. Yeah, like 2007, it wasn't really happening, right? Mm-hmm. I moved here in 2017. It's like, oh, this, I don't even have to. They even got special ones for us. The green ones. Way to go.
The green ones, exactly.
Appreciate you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
they'll go up from Midtown.
Yes.
Because you could be in Midtown and say, yeah, I'm going to 135th. Like, not in this car, you're not.
Yeah, I've never had anybody turn me down on location since I moved here. It's mm-hmm. definitely happened prior.
Yep.
No question.
All right,
but
no doubt.
Now, you mentioned Paul Brown a little bit earlier, and you are a baseball guy first and foremost. Here's what I wanted to bring up about Paul Brown that I think is just kind of a generally interesting thing, which is Paul Brown is a significant figure in the integration of professional football and in college football. We talk about what his time at Ohio State and everything else. But like baseball has leaned in on the idea that it played a role in the integration of America, even though the NFL was integrated before baseball was. Baseball meant something different. So Jackie Robinson means something different.
Sure.
And even if it's just like window dressing, the surface level stuff, baseball leans in on it. Basketball and football have never leaned in on their branch Rickies in that
no,
way.
They have not.
Like, Red Auerbach, who, Red Auerbach and Paul Brown, both really famous coaches, somehow that's not the top line on their resumes when it had so much to do with their success.
Well, it depends on where you're from. If you're from Boston, where I am from, it was drilled into you that the Celtics were, you know, because Boston got called racist often. It was like, well, what about the Celtics? And everybody talked about the Celtics. It was like, that was Boston's number one shield. Well, Red Auerbach drafted Chuck Cooper, and Red Auerbach hired the first black coach, and Red Auerbach put five black players on the court at the same time. So what about Red? So for me, the Celtic legacy is part of growing up. I already knew it. We already knew that. And Red, but you're absolutely right. It never went national. It didn't even stay in Boston after a certain number of years. And part of the reason probably was because I think on the one hand, you don't have either sport really taken off until baseball is already well, well, well established and the Robinson legend is already well established. So it was like, okay, we can't compete with that. But on the other hand, I think the other reason was because the players themselves didn't play along. One thing you know about Jackie is that Jackie played along. Jackie was like, I was the principal actor in Mr. Ricky's drama, and he wrote along. Those two went into the sunset together. You talk to Bill Russell, he'll say what he had to say about Red, but he had way, way, way more worse things to say about Boston. And you talk about Jim Brown, same thing. You know, Jim Brown may have things to say about Paul Brown, but Jim Brown didn't like Paul Brown. They did not get along. So you didn't get the black actor to play along to be that sort of spear of lightning the way Branch Rickey had that with Jackie. And I think that's really significant. I think if Jim Brown or Bill Russell had both played along, maybe that story is different. But baseball had such a head start in terms of the national as the national game anyway. Nobody cared about football, really. And also football, too. Baseball, the fact that baseball integrated before football because Jackie signed in 45, even though the NFL integrated on the pro, the actual black player playing was 46 with Kenny Washington and Marion Motley and those dudes. I think that just football just wasn't as popular. Just now, if all this is happening in, say, 1970, 1980, somewhere in there where football began to overtake baseball, different story, but football just, college football was more popular than pro football in 1945.
The other thing about Auerbach, too, to never forget, is he's also the man that looked up and was like, yeah, those teams didn't sell no tickets.
And they didn't sell. And that was the other thing.
Not only are we going to put some white dudes at the end of the bench where they don't matter, but if there is a halfway decent white dude in any draft, I will find a way
to take him.
And
that exists to this day. I mean, maybe a little less so now, but even in, you know, Danny was going to go out of his mind to get Frank Kaminsky. Frank Kaminsky.
And Jordan beat him to it. But the thing about it, though, is I'll always give this to Red, though. Like, Larry Bird and Kevin McHale, yeah, you do what you got to do to get those dudes. It didn't become a problem until he started getting the Michael Smiths of the world.
Until he got Michael Smith and Dino Roger, and they really couldn't play.
Yes, that's when it was like, hey, man, you're going a little too far on this, buddy. Game done changed.
Well, and let's not forget, Larry, for all the things that Larry talked about with this, you know, Larry also, you know, he rode hard on Austin Crozier.
Yeah, he did. But you know what, though? He rode hard on Austin Crozier, and the big one was, look what happened to that roster after the brawl.
That's right.
When Bill Simmons is writing in columns that their motto should be, what can white do for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that. He's like, look, man, I got to get people to come back. The block is hot. Y'all too hot right now. We need something else. But with the NFL, like the stories that Jim Brown was talking about with Paul Brown, and we'll, you know, farther in the book, we'll get into this, but it's pretty amazing, though, that Jim Brown was good enough in the 1960s to win a power struggle with the man who at that point might have been considered to be the best coach in the history of football.
That's right. But once again, this is the thing that Jim Brown, when you think about Jim Brown as a man, he understood his worth. And that's the thing that everyone keeps trying to get players to understand. You actually do have leverage here. You may not think you do, but you actually do have an enormous amount of power. And I think that in reading those sections, especially the sections where Paul Brown is giving these speeches and Mike was writing about how it felt like he was talking to a bunch of five-year-olds, this is the reason why I was like, yeah, I don't have any talent, but I also didn't have the mentality to be an athlete. I couldn't listen to that. And to be humiliated by, and to be disposable. They really are humiliating paragraphs, but they're also illuminating in so many ways. You got to be of a certain mindset. And also the fact that when they're talking about the level of discipline that these men need, that these boys needed through sports and everything else, and how Paul Brown was one of these guys, you know, who would tell you how you were going to act. The racism in those sentences, just the actual code. You don't even need code in there. It really is powerful, and I think I'm answering my own question about whether or not you need to contextualize it or just let it sit there, because letting it sit there was plenty.
Yeah, no, I mean, some of those things just, and when you listen to the, like, what the racism was, it was so basic, right? Like, you know, like this isn't, it is a grand conspiracy that in a lot of ways just kind of operates and works on its own. But like the fact that he's always being compared to this one black dude they had
at
one
time. Well.
To the other
one. That reminds me, that, speaking of players, that reminds me of whenever you would talk to Keith Van Horn. And everybody kept trying to compare Keith Van Horn to Larry Bird. And Keith Van Horn would say, no, my game's like Derek McKee.
Derek, of all people. By the way, his game was nothing like Derek McKee's. But that's what he wanted it to be.
Kind of pattern my game after. But we see that happen all the time. And that's the thing. It's like, I think when you're reading biography and you're thinking, how much are you reading the book to learn about the person, and how much are you reading the book to sort of validate your own worldview? And this is how you can tell. It's like when I watch a movie, I decide, are you ready to ride with this director and what the director, where the director is going? If you're willing to take a ride with that director, chances are you're going to like the movie. If you're like, yeah, I don't really buy it, then it's probably not going to work. If you want to understand who Jim Brown is, this book is terrific. I mean, there's no way you can read the first 100 pages of this book and say, I don't know how he is the way he is. You read it and you say, I don't know how he could be any other way. Because the customs are so crushing. And so, okay, if you want to be like, you know, whether it's, you know, the personality like a Roy Campanella or a personality like a Jackie Robinson or a person like a Jim Brown or a Bill Russell, these guys had to live in this. And how you navigated this was going to determine what kind of person you ended up being.
All right. That is our man, Howard Bryant. Check out The Heritage. This is a book that he put out last year. The Heritage came out, right?
Yes, sir.
Time flies, man. But absolutely, right? Check that out. It is a great book. And this is our, you know, we're doing the Right Time Book Club here. Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. We're 100 pages in. Lonnie O'Neill will join us at the end of July to talk about this. Mike Freeman will join us in August. And my man, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, man, my pleasure.
All right, man. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. Do this thing here a couple times a week. Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Howard Bryant for joining us. By the way, the SB Day auction is upon us. Want a chance to celebrate J-Lo's 50th birthday with her in Miami? You will be a star yourself as you take in one of the biggest concerts of the year and get to meet the triple threat superstar herself in person. Head over to ebay.com/ESPN for details. All proceeds benefit the V Foundation for Cancer Research, and the fight against cancer will never give up. Also, remember, subscribe to The Right Time Podcast wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. Yelling goes 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we will talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.